for the gods must always be found somehow, even when the land starves. The great gateway was opened. I could see cold early dawn through it. Outside, priests and girls were singing. There must have been a great mob of the rabble, too. In the pauses you could hear, who could mistake it, their noise. No herd of other beasts gathered together has so ugly a voice as man. For a long time I could not see Psyche at all. The gods are cleverer than we, and can always think of some vileness it never entered our heads to fear. When at last I saw her, that was the worst of all. She sat upright on an open litter between the king and the priest. The reason I had not known her was that they had painted and gilded and bewigged her like a temple girl. I could not even tell whether she saw me or not. Her eyes, peering out of the heavy, lifeless mask which they had made of her face, were utterly strange. You couldn't even see in what direction she was looking. It is in its way admirable, this divine skill. It was not enough for the gods to kill her. They must make her father the murderer. It was not enough to take her from me. They must take her from me three times over, tear out my heart three times. First her sentence, then her strange, cold talk last night, and now this painted and gilded horror to poison my last sight of her. Ungate had taken the most beautiful thing that was ever born, and made it into an ugly doll. They told me afterwards that I tried to start going down the stairway and fell. They carried me to my bed. For many days after that I was sick, and most of them I do not remember. I was not in my right mind, and slept, they tell me, not at all. My ravings, what I can recall of them, were a ceaseless torture of tangled diversity, yet also of sameness. Everything changed into something else before you could understand it, yet the new thing always stabbed you in the very same place. One thread ran through all the delusions. Now mark yet again the cruelty of the gods. There is no escape from them into sleep or madness, for they can pursue you into them with dreams. Indeed, you are then most at their mercy. The nearest thing we have to a defence against them, but there is no real defence, is to be very wide awake and sober and hard at work, to hear no music, never to look at earth or sky, and above all, to love no one. And now, finding me heart-shattered for Psyche's sake, they made it the common burden of all my fantasies that Psyche was my greatest enemy. All my sense of intolerable wrong was directed against her. It was she who hated me. It was on her that I wanted to be revenged. Sometimes she and Redival and I were all children together, and then Psyche and Redival would drive me away and put me out of the game, and stand with their arms linked, laughing at me. Sometimes I was beautiful and had a lover who looked, absurdly, a little like poor eunuch Tarin, or a little like Bardia. I suppose because his was the last man's face, almost, that I had seen before I fell ill. But on the very threshold of the bridal chamber, or from the very bedside, Psyche, wigged and masked and no bigger than my forearm, would lead him away with one finger. And when they got to the door they would turn round and mock and point at me. But these were the clearest visions. More often it was all confused and dim. Psyche throwing me down high precipices. Psyche, now very like the king, but still Psyche, kicking me and dragging me by the hair. Psyche with a torch or a sword or a whip, pursuing me over vast swamps and dark mountains, I running to save my life. But always wrong, hatred, mockery, and my determination to be avenged. The beginning of my recovery was when the visions ceased, and left behind them only a settled sense of some great injury that Psyche had done me, though I could not gather my wits to think what it was. They say I lay for hours saying, "Cruel girl, cruel Psyche, her heart is of stone." And soon I was in my right mind again, and knew how I loved her, and that she had never willingly done me any wrong, though it hurt me somewhat that she should have found time at our last meeting of all, talking so little of me, to talk so much about the god of the mountain, and the king, and the fox, and Redival, and even Bardia. Soon after that I was aware of a pleasant noise that had already been going on a long time. "What is it?" I asked, and was astonished at the weak croak of my voice. "What is what, child?" said the voice of the fox. And I knew somehow that he had been sitting by my bed for many hours. "The noise, grandfather, above our heads." "That is the reindeer," he said. "Give thanks to Zeus for that and for your own recovery. And I... But you must sleep again. And drink this first." I saw the tears on his face as he gave me the cup. I had no broken bones. The bruises were gone, and my other pains with them, but I was very weak. Weakness and work are two comforts the gods have not taken from us. I'd not write it. It might move them to take these also away, except that they must know it already. I was too weak now to feel much grief or anger. These days before my strength came back were almost happy. The fox was very loving and tender, and much weakened himself, and so were my women. I was loved more than I had thought. And my sleeps were sweet now, and there was much rain, and between whiles the kind south wind blowing in at the window, and sunshine. For a long time we never spoke of Psyche. We talked, when we talked at all, of common things. They had much to tell me. The weather had changed the very day after my sickness began. The Shenet was full again. The breaking of the drought had come too late to save the crops for the most part. One or two fields put up a little, but garden stuff was growing. Above all, the grass was reviving wonderfully. We should save far more of the cattle than we had hoped, and the fever was clean gone. My own sickness had been of another kind. And birds were coming back to Gloam, so that every woman whose husband could shoot with a bow or set a snare might soon have something in the pot. These things I heard of from the women as well as from the fox. When we were alone, he told me other news. My father was now, while it lasted, the darling of his people. It seemed, this was how we first came round to the matter nearest our hearts, he had been much pitied and praised at the great offering. Up there at the holy tree he had wailed and wept and torn his robes and embraced Psyche countless times. He had never done it before, but said again and again that he would not withhold his heart's dearest when the good of the people called for her death. The whole crowd was in tears, as the fox had been told. He himself, as a slave and an alien, had not been there. "Did you know, grandfather," said I, "that the king was such a mountebank?" We were talking in Greek, of course. "Not wholly that, child," said the fox. "He believed it while he did it. His tears are no falser or truer than Redivald's." Then he went on to tell me of the great news from Fars. A fool in the crowd had said the king of Fars had 13 sons. The truth is, he had begotten 8, whereof one died in childhood. The eldest was simple and could never rule, and the king, as some said their laws allowed him, had named Argan the Third as his successor. And now it seemed his second son, Trunia, taking it ill to be put out of the succession, and doubtless fomenting some other discontent, such as are never far to seek in any land, had risen in rebellion with a strong following to recover what he called his right. The upshot was that all Fars was likely to be busy with civil war for a 12-month at least, and both parties were already as soft as butter towards Gloam, so that we were safe from any threat in that quarter. A few days later, when the fox was with me, often he could not be, for the king needed him, I said, "Grandfather, do you still think that Ungit has only lies of poets and priests?" "Why not, child? If she were indeed a goddess, what more could have followed my poor sister's death than has followed it? All the dangers and plagues that hung over us have been scattered. Why, the wind must have changed the very day after they had—" I found now I could not give it a name. The grief was coming back with my strength. So was the fox's. "Cursed chance! Cursed chance!" he muttered, his face all screwed up, partly in anger and partly to keep back his tears. Greek men cry easily as women. "It is these chances that nourish the beliefs of barbarians." "How often, grandfather, you have told me there's no such thing as chance." "You're right, it was an old trick of the tongue. I meant that all these things have no more to do with that murder than with anything else. They and it are all part of the same web, which is called nature, or the whole. That southwest wind came over 1,000 miles of sea and land. The weather of the whole world would have to have been different from the beginning if that wind was not to blow. It's all one web. You can't pick threads out nor put them in. And so, said I, raising myself on my elbow, she died to no purpose. If the king had waited a few days later, we could have saved her, for all would have begun to go well of itself, and this you call comfort? Not this. Their evil doing was vain and ignorant, as all evil deeds are. This is our comfort, that the evil was theirs, not hers. They say there was not a tear in her eye, nor did so much as her hand shake when they put her to the tree. Not even when they turned away and left her did she cry out. She died full of all things that are really good, courage and patience and...
Oh, Psyche! Oh, my little one!
And his love got the better of his philosophy, and he pulled his mantle over his head and at last, still weeping, left me. Next day he said, "You saw yesterday, daughter, how little progress I have made. I began to philosophize too late. You are younger and can go further. To love and to lose what we love are equally things appointed for our nature. If we cannot bear the second well, that evil is ours." It did not befall Psyche. If we look at it with reason's eye and not with our passions, what good that life offers did she not win? Chastity, temperance, prudence, meekness, clemency, valour? And though fame is froth, yet if we should reckon it at all, a name that stands with Iphigenia's and Antigone's. Of course he had long since told me those stories, so often that I had them by heart, mostly in the very words of the poets. Nevertheless, I asked him to tell me them again, chiefly for his sake, for I was now old enough to know that a man, above all a Greek man, can find comfort in words coming out of his own mouth. But I was glad to hear them too. These were peaceful, familiar things, and would keep at bay the great desolation, which now, with my returning health, was beginning to mix itself in every thought. Next day, being then for the first time risen, I said to him, "Grandfather, I have missed being Iphigenia. I can be Antigone." "Antigone? How, child?" "She gave her brother burial." "I, too. There may be something left. Even the brute would not eat bones and all. I must go up to the tree. I will bring them back, if I can, and burn them rightly. Or if there's too much, I'll bury it up there." "It would be pious," said the fox. "It would accord with custom, if not with nature. If you can, it's late in the year now for going up the mountain."
"That's why it must be done speedily. I think it will be about 25 days before the earliest snow."
"If you can, child, you've been very sick."
"It's all I can do," said I.
Chapter 9. I was soon able to go about the house and in the gardens again. I did it in some stealth, for the fox told the king I was still sick. Otherwise he would have had me off to the pillar room to work for him. He often asked, "Where's that girl got to? Does she mean to slug a bed for the rest of her life, and not feed drones in my hive forever?" The loss of Psyche had not at all softened him to Redivale and me, rather the opposite. "To hear him talk," said the fox, "you'd think no father ever loved a child better than he, Psyche." The gods had taken his darling and left him the dross, the young whore, that was Redivale, and the hobgoblin, which was I. But I could guess it all without the fox's reports to help me. For my own part, I was busily thinking out how I could make my journey to the tree on the mountain, and gather whatever might remain of Psyche. I had talked lightly enough of doing this, and was determined that I would do it, but the difficulties were very great. I had never been taught to ride any beast, so I must go on foot. I knew it would take a man who knew the way about 6 hours to go from the palace to the tree. I, a woman, and one who had to find her way, must allow myself 8 at the least. and 2 more for the work I went to do, and, say, 6 for the journey home. There were 16 hours in all. It could not be done in one stitch. I must reckon to lie out a night on the mountain, and must take food, water I should find, and warm clothing. It could not be done till I recovered my full strength. And in truth, as I now see, I had the wish to put off my journey as long as I could. Not for any peril or labour it might cost, but because I could see nothing in the whole world for me to do once it was accomplished. As long as this act lay before me, there was, as it were, some barrier between me and the dead desert which the rest of my life must be. Once I had gathered Psyche's bones, then it seemed all that concerned her would be over and done with. Already, even with the great act still ahead, there was flowing in upon me from the barren years beyond it a dejection such as I had never conceived. It was not at all like the agonies I had endured before and have endured since. I did not weep nor wring my hands. I was like water put into a bottle and left in a cellar, utterly motionless, never to be drunk, poured out, spilled, or shaken. The days were endless. The very shadows seemed nailed to the ground, as if the sun no longer moved. One day, when this deadness was at its worst, I came into the house by the little door that leads into a narrow passage between the guards' quarters and the dairy. I sat down on the threshold, less weary of body, for the gods, not out of mercy, have made me strong, than unable to find a reason for going a step further in any direction or for doing anything at all. A fat fly was crawling up the doorpost. I remember thinking that its sluggish crawling, seemingly without aim, was like my life, or even the life of the whole world. "Lady," said a voice behind me. I looked up. It was Bardia. "Lady," he said, "I'll make free with you. I've known sorrow, too. I've been as you are now. I've sat and felt the hours drawn out to the length of years. What cured me was the wars. I don't think there's any other cure."
"But I can't go to the wars, Bardia," said I.
"You can, almost," he said. "When you fought me outside the other princess's door, peace be on her, the blessed, I told you you had a good eye and a good reach. You thought I was saying it to cheer you. Well, so perhaps I was, but it was true, too. There's no one in the quarters, and there are blunt swords. Come in and let me give you a lesson."
"No," said I dully. "I don't want to. What would be the use?"
"Use? Try it and see. No one can be sad while they're using wrist and hand and eye and every muscle of their body. That's truth, lady, whether you believe it or not. As well, it would be 100 shames not to train anyone who has such a gift for the sport as you look like having."
"No," said I, "leave me alone, unless we can use sharps and you would kill me."
"That's women's talk, by your favour. You'd never say that again once you'd seen it done. Come, I'll not leave off till you do."
A big, kindly man, some years older than herself, can usually persuade even a sad and sullen girl. In the end I rose and went in with him.
"That shield is too heavy," he said. "Here's the one for you. Slip it on, thus. And understand from the outset your shield is a weapon, not a wall. You're fighting with it every bit as much as your sword. Watch me now. You see the way I twist my shield, make it flicker like a butterfly? There'd be arrows and spears and sword points flying off it in every direction if we were in a hot engagement. Now, here's your sword. No, not like that. You want to grip it firm but light. It's not a wild animal that's trying to run away from you. That's better. Now your left foot forward. And don't look at my face, look at my sword. It isn't my face that's going to fight you. And now I'll show you a few guards."
He kept me at it for a full half hour. It was the hardest work I'd ever done, and while it lasted one could think of nothing else. I said not long before that work and weakness are comforters, but sweat is the kindest creature of the three, far better than philosophy as a cure for ill thoughts.
"That's enough," said Bardia. "You're shaped very well. I'm sure now I can make a swordsman of you. You'll come again tomorrow. But your dress hampers you. It would be better if you could wear something that came only to your knee."
I was in such a heat that I went across the passage into the dairy and drank a bowl of milk.
It was the first food or drink that I had really relished ever since the bad times began. While I was in there, one of the other soldiers, I suppose he had had a sight of what we were doing, came into the passage and said something to Bardia. Bardia replied, I couldn't hear what. Then he spoke louder. "Why, yes, it's a pity about her face, but she's a brave girl and honest. If a man was blind, and she weren't the king's daughter, she'd make him a good wife." And that is the nearest thing to a love speech that was ever made me. I had my lesson with Bardia every day after that, and I knew soon that he had been a good doctor to me. My grief remained, but the numbness was gone, and time moved at its right pace again. Soon I told Bardia how I wished to go to the Grey Mountain, and why. "That's very well thought of, lady," he said. "I'm ashamed I've not done it myself. We all owe the blessed princess that much at the least. But there's no need for you to go. I'll go for you." I said I would go. "Then you must go with me," he said. "You'd never find the place by yourself. And you might meet a bear or wolves or a mountainy man, an outlaw. That'd be worse. Can you ride a horse, lady?"
"No, I've never been taught."
He wrinkled up his brow, thinking. "One horse will do," he said. "I in the saddle and you behind me. And it won't take 6 hours getting up. There's a shorter way. But the work we have to do might take long enough. We'll need to sleep a night on the mountain."
"Will the king let you be absent so long, Bardia?"
He chuckled. "Oh, I'll spin the king a story easily enough. He isn't with us as he is with you, lady. For all his hard words, he's no bad master to soldiers, shepherds, huntsmen and the like. He understands them, and they him. You see him at his worst with women and priests and politic men. The truth is, he's half afraid of them." This was very strange to me. 6 days after that, I and Bardia set out at the milking time of the morning, the day being so cloudy that it was almost as dark as full night. No one in the palace knew of our going, except the fox and my own women. I had on a plain black cloak with a hood and a veil over my face. Under the mantle I wore the short smock that I used for my fencing bouts, with a man's belt and a sword, this time a sharp one at my side. "Most likely we'll meet nothing worse than a wildcat or a fox," Bardia had said, "but no one, man or maid, ought to go weaponless up the hills." I sat with both my legs on one side of the horse, and a hand on Bardia's girdle. With the other I held on my knees an urn. It was all silent in the city, but for the clatter of our own beasts' hoofs, though here and there you would see a light in a window. A sharp rain came on us from behind our backs as we went down from the city to the ford of the Shenet, but it ceased as we were crossing the water, and the clouds began to break. There was still no sign of dawn ahead, for it was in that direction the foul weather was packing off. We passed the house of Ungit on our right. Its fashion is thus: great ancient stones, twice the height of a man and four times the thickness of a man, set upright in an egg-shaped ring. These are very ancient, and no one knows who set them up or brought them into that place or how. In between the stones it is filled up with brick to make the wall complete. The roof is thatched with rushes, and not level but somewhat domed, so that the whole thing is a roundish hump, most like a huge slug lying on the field. This is a holy shape, and the priests say it resembles, or in a mystery, that it really is, the egg from which the whole world was hatched, or the womb in which the whole world once lay. Every spring the priest is shut into it, and fights, or makes believe to fight, his way out through the western door, and this means that the new year is born. There was smoke going up from it as we passed, for the fire before Ungit is always alight. I found my mood changed as soon as we had left Ungit behind, partly because we were now going into country I had never known, and partly because I felt as if the air was sweeter as we got away from all that holiness. The mountain, now bigger ahead of us, still shut out the brightening of the day, but when I looked back and saw beyond the city those hills where Psyche and I and the fox used to wander, I perceived that it was already morning there, and further off still the clouds in the western sky were beginning to turn pale rose. We were going up and down little hills, but always more up than down, on a good enough road with grasslands on each side of us. There were dark woods on our left, and presently the road bent towards them. But here Bardia left the road and took to the grass. "That's the holy road," he said, pointing to the woods. "That's the way they took the blessed, peace be on her. Our way will be steeper and shorter." We now went for a long time over grass, gently but steadily upward, making for a ridge so high and so near that the true mountain was quite out of sight. When we topped it, and stood for a while to let the horse breathe, everything was changed, and my struggle began. We had come into the sunlight now, too bright to look into, and warm. I threw back my cloak. Heavy dew made the grass jewel bright. The mountain, far greater, yet also far further off than I expected, seen with the sun hanging a handbreadth above its topmost crags, did not look like a solid thing. Between us and it was a vast tumble of valley and hill, woods and cliffs, and more little lakes than I could count. To left and right and behind us, the whole coloured world with all its hills was heaped up and up to the sky, with far away a gleam of what we call the sea, though it is not to be compared with the great sea of the Greeks. There was a lark singing, but for that, huge and ancient stillness. And my struggle was this. You may well believe that I'd set out sad enough. I came on a sad errand. Now, flung at me like frolic or insolence, there came as if it were a voice, no words, but if you made it into words it would be, "Why should your heart not dance?" It's the measure of my folly that my heart almost answered, "Why not?" I had to tell myself over, like a lesson, the infinite reasons it had not to dance. My heart to dance? Mine, whose love was taken from me? I, the ugly princess who must never look for other love, the drudge of the king, the jailer of hateful Redival, perhaps to be murdered or turned out as a beggar when my father died, for who knew what Gloam would do then? And yet it was a lesson I could hardly keep in my mind. The sight of the huge world put mad ideas into me, as if I could wander away, wander forever, see strange and beautiful things one after the other to the world's end. The freshness and wetness all about me, I'd seen nothing but drought and withered things for many months before my sickness, made me feel that I'd misjudged the world. It seemed kind and laughing, as if its heart also danced. Even my ugliness I could not quite believe in. Who can feel ugly when the heart meets delight? It is as if somewhere inside, within the hideous face and bony limbs, one is soft, fresh, lissome, and desirable. We had stood on the ridge only for a short time, but for hours later, while we went up and down, winding among great hills, often dismounting and leading the horse, sometimes on dangerous edges, the struggle went on. Was I not right to struggle against this fool-happy mood? Mere seemliness, if nothing else, called for it. I would not go laughing to Psyche's burial. If I did, how should I ever again believe that I had loved her? Reason called for it. I knew the world too well to believe this sudden smiling. What woman can have patience with a man who can be yet again deceived by his doxy's fawning after he has thrice proved her false? I should be just like such a man, if a mere burst of fair weather and fresh grass after a long drought, and health after sickness, could make me friends again with this god-haunted, plague-breeding, decaying, tyrannous world. I had seen, I was not a fool. I did not know then, however, as I do now, the strongest reason for distrust. The gods never send us this invitation to delight so readily or so strongly as when they are preparing some new agony. We are their bubbles. They blow us big before they prick us. But I held my own without that knowledge. I ruled myself. Did they think I was nothing but a pipe to be played on as their moment's fancy chose? The struggle ended when we topped the last rise before the real mountain. We were so high now that, although the sun was very strong, the wind blew bitterly cold. At our feet, Between us and the mountain lay a cursed black valley. Dark moss, dark peat bogs, shingle, great boulders, and screes of stone sprawling down into it from the mountain, as if the mountain had sores, and these were the stony issue from them. The great mass of it rose up, we tilted our heads back to look at it, into huge knobbles of stone against the sky, like an old giant's back teeth. The face it showed us was really no steeper than a roof, except for certain frightful cliffs on our left, but it looked as if it went up like a wall. It, too, was now black. Here the gods ceased trying to make me glad. There was nothing here that even the merriest heart could dance for. Bardia pointed ahead to our right. There the mountain fell away in a smooth sweep, to a saddle somewhat lower than the ground we stood on, but still with nothing behind it but the sky. Against the sky, on the saddle, stood a single leafless tree. We went down into the black valley on our own feet, leading the horse, for the going was bad and stones slipped away from under us, until at the lowest place we joined the sacred road. It came into the valley through the northern end, away to our left. We were so near now that we did not mount again. A few loops of the road led us up to the saddle, and once more into the biting wind. I was afraid now that we were almost at the tree. I can hardly say of what, but I know that to find the bones, or even the body, would have set my fear at rest. I believe I had a senseless child's fear that she might be neither living nor dead. And now we were there. The iron girdle and the chain that went from it about the gaunt trunk, there was no bark on the tree, hung there and made a dull noise from time to time as they moved with the wind. There were no bones, nor rags of clothing, nor marks of blood, nor anything else. "How do you read these signs, Bardia?" said I. "The gods taken her," said he, rather pale and speaking low. He was a God-fearing man. "No natural beast would have licked his plate so clean. There'd be bones. A beast, any but the holy shadow brute itself, couldn't have got the whole body out of the irons. And it wouldn't have left the jewels. A man now. But a man couldn't have freed her unless he had tools with him." I had not thought of our journeys being so vain. Nothing to do, nothing to gather. The emptiness of my life was to begin at once. "We can search about a bit," I said, foolishly, for I had no hope of finding anything. "Yes, yes, lady, we can search about," said Bardia. I knew it was only his kindness that spoke. And so we did, working round in circles, he one way and I the other, with our eyes on the ground. Very cold, one's cloak flapping till leg and cheeks smarted with the blows of it. Bardia was ahead of me now, eastward and further across the saddle, when he called out. I had to thrust back the hair that was whipping about my face before I could see him. I rushed to him, half flying, for the west wind made a sail of my cloak. He showed me what he had found, a ruby. "I never saw her wear such a stone," said I.
"She did, though, lady, on her last journey. They'd put their own holy gear on her. The straps of the sandals were red with rubies."
"Oh, Bardia, then somebody, something, carried her thus far?"
"Or maybe carried only the sandals. A jackdaw'd do it."
"We must go on, further on this line."
"Carefully, lady. If we must, I'll do it. You'd best stay behind."
"Why, what's to fear? And anyway, I'll not stay behind."
"I don't know that anyone's been over the saddle. At the offering, even the priests come no further than the tree. We're very near the bad part of the mountain. I mean the holy part. Beyond the tree, it's all God's country, they say."
"Then it is you must stay behind, Bardia. They can't do worse to me than they've done already."
"I'll go where you go, lady. But let's talk less of them, or not at all. And first, I must go back and get the horse."
He went back, and for a moment out of sight I stood alone on the edge of the perilous land, to where he had tied the horse to a little stunted bush. Then he rejoined me, leading it, very grave, and we went forward.
"Carefully,"
he said again. "We may find we're on the top of a cliff any moment." And indeed it looked for the next few paces as if we were walking straight into the empty sky. Then suddenly we found we were on the brow of a steep slope, and at the same moment the sun, which had been overcast ever since we went down into the Black Valley, leaped out. It was like looking down into a new world. At our feet, cradled amid a vast confusion of mountains, lay a small valley, bright as a gem, but opening southward on our right. Through that opening there was a glimpse of warm, blue lands, hills and forests, far below us. The valley itself was like a cleft in the mountain's southern chin. High though it was, the year seemed to have been kinder in it than down in Glome. I never saw greener turf. There was gorse in bloom, and wild vines, and many groves of flourishing trees, and great plenty of bright water, pools, streams, and little cataracts. And when, after casting about a little to find where the slope would be easiest for the horse, we began descending, the air came up to us warmer and sweeter every minute. We were out of the wind now, and could hear ourselves speak. Soon we could hear the very chattering of the streams and the sound of bees. "This may well be the secret valley of the god," said Bardia, his voice hushed. "It's secret enough," said I. Now we were at the bottom, and so warm that I had half a mind to dip my hands and face in the swift amber water of the stream which still divided us from the main of the valley. I had already lifted my hand to put aside my veil, when I heard two voices cry out, one Bardia's. I looked. A quivering shock of feeling that has no name but is nearest terror stabbed through me from head to foot. There, not 6 feet away on the far side of the river, stood Psyche. Chapter 10. What I babbled between tears and laughter in the first wildness of my joy, the water still between us, I don't know. I was recalled by Bardia's voice. "Careful, lady. It may be her wraith. It may—" Aye, it is the bride of the god. It is a goddess." He was deadly white and bending down to throw earth on his forehead. You could not blame him. She was so bright-faced, as we say in Greek. But I felt no holy fear. What, I to fear the very Psyche whom I had carried in my arms and taught to speak and to walk? She was tanned by sun and wind and clothed in rags, but laughing, her eyes like two stars, her limbs smooth and rounded, and, but for the rags, no sign of beggary or hardship about her. "Welcome, welcome, welcome," she was saying. "Oh, Maya, I have longed for this. It was my only longing. I knew you would come. Oh, how happy I am. And good Bardia, too. It was he that brought you? Of course, I might have guessed it. Come, Orwell, you must cross the stream. I'll show you where it's easiest. But, Bardia, I can't bid you across. Dear Bardia, it's not—"
"No, no, blessed Istra," said Bardia, and I thought he was very relieved. "I'm only a soldier." Then, in a lower voice to me, "Will you go, lady? This is a very dreadful place. Perhaps—"
"Go," said I. "I'd go if the river flowed with fire instead of water."
"Of course," said he. "It's not with you as with us. You have God's blood in you. I'll stay here with the horse. We're out of the wind, and there's good grass for him here."
I was already on the edge of the river. "A little further up, Orwell," Psyche was saying. "Here's the best ford. Go straight ahead off that big stone. Gently. Make your footing sure. No, not to your left. It's very deep in places. This way. Now, one step more. Reach out for my hand." I suppose the long bedridden and indoors time of my sickness had softened me. Anyhow, the coldness of that water shocked all the breath out of me, and the current was so strong that but for Psyche's hand, I think it would have knocked me down and rolled me under. I even thought momentarily, amid a thousand other things, how strong she grows. She'll be a stronger woman than ever I was. She'll have that as well as her beauty. The next was all a confusion, trying to talk, to cry, to kiss, to get my breath back, all together. But she led me a few paces beyond the river and made me sit in the warm heather and sat beside me, our four hands joined in my lap, just as it had been that night in her prison. "Why, sister," she said merrily, "you found my threshold cold and steep. You're breathless, but I'll refresh you." She jumped up, went a little way off, and came back carrying something, the little cool, dark berries of the mountain in a green leaf. "Eat," she said. "Is it not food fit for the gods?" "Nothing sweeter," said I. And indeed I was both hungry and thirsty enough by now, for it was noon or later. "But, oh, Psyche, tell me how—" "Wait," said she, "after the banquet, the wine." Close beside us a little silvery trickle came out from among stones, mossed, cushioned soft. She held her two hands under it till they were filled, and raised them to my lips. "Have you ever tasted a nobler wine," she said, "or in a fairer cup?" "It is indeed a good drink," said I, "but the cup is better. It is the cup I love best in the world." "Then it's yours, sister." She said it with such a pretty air of courtesy, like a queen and hostess giving gifts, that the tears came into my eyes again. It brought back so many of her plays in childhood. "Thank you, child," said I. "I hope it is mine indeed. But, Psyche, we must be serious. Yes, and busy, too. How have you lived? How did you escape? Oh, we mustn't let the joy of the moment put it out of our minds. What are we to do now?" "Do? I'd be merry. What else? Why should our hearts not dance?" "They do dance. Do you not think? Why, I could forgive the gods themselves. I'll shortly be able to forgive Redivar, perhaps. But how can—" "It will be winter in a month or less. You can't—" "Psyche, how have you kept alive till now? I thought... But to think of what I had thought overcame me. "Hush, Maya, hush," said Psyche. Once more it was she who was comforting me. "All those fears are over. All's well. I'll make it well for you, too. I'll not rest till you're as happy as I. But you haven't yet even asked me my story. Weren't you surprised to find this fair dwelling-place and me living here like this? Have you no wonder?" "Yes, Psyche, I'm overwhelmed in it. Of course I want to hear your story, unless we should make our plans first."
"Solemn Orwell," said Psyche mockingly, "you were always one for plans. And rightly too, Maya, with such a foolish child as me to bring up. And well you did it." With one light kiss, she put all those days, all of my life that I cared for, behind us, and began her story. I wasn't in my right mind when we left the palace. Before the two temple girls began painting and dressing me, they gave me a sweet, sticky stuff to drink, a drug, as I guess, for soon after I'd swallowed it everything went dreamlike, and more so for a long time. And I think, sister, they must always give that to those whose blood is to be poured over Ungit, and that's why we see them die so patiently. And the painting on my face helped the dreaminess, too. It made my face stiff till it didn't seem to be my own face. I couldn't feel it was I who was being sacrificed. And then the music and incense and the torches made it more so. I saw you, Orwell, at the top of the stairway, but I couldn't lift even a hand to wave to you. My arms were as heavy as lead. And I thought it didn't matter much, because you too would wake up presently and find it was all a dream. And in a sense it was, wasn't it? And you're nearly awake now. What, still so grave? I must wake you more. You'd think the cold air would have given me my mind back when we came out of the great gates, but the drug must have been still coming to its full power. I had no fear, nor joy either. Sitting there on that litter, up above the heads of all that crowd, was a strange enough thing anyway, and the horns and the rattles were going on all the time. I don't know whether the journey up the mountain was long or short. Each bit of it was long. I noticed every pebble on the road. I looked long, long at every tree as we passed it. Yet the whole journey seemed to take hardly any time. Yet long enough for me to get some of my wits back, I began to know that something dreadful was being done to me. Then, for the first time, I wanted to speak. I tried to cry out to them that there was some mistake, that I was only poor Istra, and it couldn't be me they meant to kill. but nothing more than a kind of grunting or babbling came out of my mouth. Then a great bird-headed man, or a bird with a man's body.
"That would be the priest," said I.
"Yes, if he is still the priest when he puts on his mask. Perhaps he becomes a god while he wears it." Anyway, it said, "Give her some more," and one of the younger priests got onto someone else's shoulders and put the sweet sticky cup to my lips again. I didn't want to take it, but, you know, Maya, it all felt so like the time you had the barber to take that thorn out of my hand long ago, you remember? You holding me tight and telling me to be good and that it'd all be over in a moment. Well, it was like that, so I felt sure I'd better do whatever I was told. The next thing I knew, really knew, was that I was off the litter and on the hot earth, and they were fastening me to the tree with iron round my waist. It was the sound of the iron that cleared the last of the drug out of my mind. And there was the king, shrieking and wailing and tearing his hair. And you know, Maya, he actually looked at me, really looked, and it seemed to me he was then seeing me for the first time. But all I wished was that he would stop it, and then he and all the rest would go away and leave me alone to cry. I wanted to cry now. My mind was getting clearer and clearer, and I was terribly afraid. I was trying to be like those girls in the Greek stories that the fox is always telling us about, and I knew I could keep it up till they were gone, if only they would go quickly. "Oh, Psyche, you say all's well now. Forget that terrible time. Go on quickly and tell me how you were saved. We have so much to talk about and arrange. There's no time. Orwell, there's all the time there is. Don't you want to hear my story?"
"Of course I do. I want to hear every bit. When we're safe and...
where shall we ever be safe if we're not safe here? This is my home, Maya. And you won't understand the wonder and glory of my adventure unless you listen to the bad part. It wasn't very bad, you know."
"It's so bad I can hardly bear to listen to it."
"Oh, but wait. Well, at last they were gone, and there I was alone under the glare of the sky, with the great baked, parched mountain all round me, and not one noise to be heard. There wasn't a breath of wind, even by the tree. You remember what the last day of the drought was like? I was already thirsty. The sticky drink had done that. Then I noticed for the first time that they had so bound me that I couldn't sit down. That was when my heart really failed me. I did cry then. Oh, Maya, how badly I wanted you and the fox. And all I could do was to pray, pray, pray to the gods that whatever was going to happen to me might happen soon. But nothing happened, except that my tears made me thirstier. Then, a very long time after that, things began gathering round me."
"Things?"
"Oh, nothing dreadful. Only the mountain cattle at first. Poor lean things they were. I was sorry for them, for I thought they were as thirsty as I. And they came nearer and nearer in a great circle, but never very near, and mooed at me. And after that, there came a beast that I'd never seen before, but I think it was a lynx. It came right up close. My hands were free, and I wondered if I would be able to beat it off, but I had no need to. After advancing and drawing back I don't know how many times, I think it began by fearing me as much as I feared it. It came and sniffed at my feet, and then it stood up with its forepaws on me and sniffed again. Then it went away. I was sorry it had gone. It was a kind of company. And do you know what I was thinking all this time?"
"What?"
"At first I was trying to cheer myself with all that old dream of my gold and amber palace on the mountain, and the god, trying to believe it. But I couldn't believe in it at all. I couldn't understand how I ever had. All that, all my old longings were clean gone." I pressed her hands and said nothing, but inwardly I rejoiced. It might have been good, I don't know, to encourage that fancy the night before the offering, if it supported her. Now I was glad she'd got over it. It was a thing I could not like, unnatural and estranging. Perhaps this gladness of mine is one of the things the gods have against me. They never tell. "The only thing that did me good," she continued, "was quite different. It was hardly a thought and very hard to put into words. There was a lot of the fox's philosophy in it, things he says about gods or the divine nature, but mixed up with things the priest said, too. about the blood and the earth and how sacrifice makes the crops grow. I'm not explaining it well. It seemed to come from somewhere deep inside me, deeper than the part that sees pictures of gold and amber palaces, deeper than fears and tears. It was shapeless, but you could just hold on to it, or just let it hold on to you. Then the change came.
What change?
I didn't know well what she was talking about, but I saw she must have her way and tell the story in her own fashion. Oh, the weather, of course. I couldn't see it tied the way I was, but I could feel it. I was suddenly cool. Then I knew the sky must be filling with clouds behind my back over Gloam, for all the colours on the mountain went out, and my own shadow vanished. And then, that was the first sweet moment, a sigh of wind, west wind, came at my back. Then more and more wind. You could hear and smell and feel the rain drawing near. So then I knew quite well that the gods really are, and that I was bringing the rain. And then the wind was roaring, but it's too soft a sound to call it a roar, all round me, and rain. The tree kept some of it off me. I was holding up my hands all the time and licking the rain off them. I was so thirsty. The wind got wilder and wilder. It seemed to be lifting me off the ground, so that if it hadn't been for the iron round my waist, I'd have been blown right away up in the air. And then, at last, for a moment, I saw him.
Saw whom?
The West Wind.
Saw it?
Not it, him, the god of the wind, West Wind himself.
Were you awake, Psyche?
Oh, it was no dream. One can't dream things like that, because one's never seen things like that. He was in human shape, but you couldn't mistake him for a man. Oh, sister, you'd understand if you'd seen. How can I make you understand? You've seen lepers?
Well, of course.
And you know how healthy people look beside a leper?
You mean healthier, ruddier than ever?
Yes. Now we beside the gods are like lepers beside us.
Do you mean this god was so red?
She laughed and clapped her hands. Oh, it's no use, she said. I see I've not given you the idea at all. Never mind. You shall see gods for yourself, Arawal. It must be so. I'll make it so. Somehow there must be a way. Look, this may help you. When I saw West Wind, I was neither glad nor afraid at first. I felt ashamed.
But what of? Psyche, they hadn't stripped you naked or anything.
No, no, Maya. Ashamed of looking like a mortal. Ashamed of being a mortal.
But how could you help that?
Don't you think the things people are most ashamed of are the things they can't help?
I thought of my ugliness and said nothing.
And he took me, said Psyche, in his beautiful arms, which seemed to burn me, though the burning didn't hurt, and pulled me right out of the iron girdle, and that didn't hurt either, and I don't know how he did it, and carried me up into the air, far up above the ground, and whirled me away. Of course he was invisible again almost at once. I'd seen him only as one sees a lightning flash, but that didn't matter. Now I knew it was he, not it. I wasn't in the least afraid of sailing along in the sky, even of turning head over heels in it.
Psyche, are you sure this happened? You must have been dreaming.
And if it was a dream, sister, how do you think I came here? It's more likely everything that had happened to me before this was a dream. Why, Gloam and the King and Old Butter seem to me very like dreams now. But you hinder my tale, Maya. So he carried me through the air and set me down softly. At first I was all out of breath and too bewildered to see where I was, for West Wind is a merry, rough god. Sister, do you think young gods have to be taught how to handle us? A hasty touch from hands like theirs and we'd fall to pieces. But when I came to myself, ah, can you think what a moment that was, and saw the house before me, I lying at the threshold? And it wasn't, you see, just the gold and amber house I used to imagine. If it had been just that, I might indeed have thought I was dreaming. But I saw it wasn't. And not quite like any house in this land. Nor quite like those Greek houses the fox describes to us. Something new, never conceived of. But there, you can see for yourself. And I'll show you over every bit of it in a moment. Why need I try to show it in words? You could see it was a god's house at once. I don't mean a temple where a god is worshipped, a god's house where he lives. I would not for any wealth have gone into it, but I had to, Orwell, for there came a voice, sweet, oh, sweeter than any music, yet my hair rose at it too. And you know, Orwell, what it said? It said, "Enter your house." Yes, it called it my house. Psyche, the bride of the god. I was ashamed again, ashamed of my mortality and terribly afraid. But it would have been worse shame and worse fear to disobey. I went, cold, small and shaking, up the steps and through the porch and into the courtyard. There was no one to be seen. But then the voices came all round me, bidding me welcome.
What kind of voices?
Black women's voices. At least, as like women's voices as the wind god was like a man. And they said, "Enter, lady, enter, mistress. Do not be afraid." And they were moving as the speakers moved, though I could see no one, and leading me by their movements. And so they brought me into a cool parlour with an arched roof, where there was a table set out with fruit and wine. Such fruits as never... But you shall see. They said, "Refresh yourself, lady, before the bath. After it comes the feast." Oh, Orwell, how can I tell you what it felt like? I knew they were all spirits, and I wanted to fall at their feet. But I daren't. If they made me mistress of that house, mistress I should have to be. Yet all the time I was afraid there might be some bitter mockery in it, and that at any moment terrible laughter might break out, and...
Ah, said I with a long breath, how well I understood.
Oh, but I was wrong, sister, utterly wrong. That's part of the mortal shame. They gave me fruit, they gave me wine.
The voices gave you?
The spirits gave them to me. I couldn't see their hands. Yet, you know, it never looked as if the plates or the cup were moving of themselves. You could see that hands were doing it. And Orwell, her voice grew very low, when I took the cup, I felt the other hands touching my own. Again that burning, though without pain. That was terrible. She blushed suddenly, and I wondered why I laughed. "It wouldn't be terrible now," she said. Then they had me to the bath. You shall see it. It is in the most delicate pillared court, open to the sky, and the water is like crystal and smells as sweet as this whole valley. I was terribly shy when it came to taking off my clothes, but
you said they were all she-spirits.
Oh, Maya, you still don't understand. This shame has nothing to do with he or she. It's the being mortal, being... how shall I say it? Insufficient. Don't you think a dream would feel shy if it were seen walking about in the waking world? And then, she was speaking more and more quickly now, they dressed me again in the most beautiful things, and then came the banquet, and the music, and then they had me to bed, and the night came, and then... He. The bridegroom. The god himself. "Don't look at me like that, sister. I'm your own true Psyche still. Nothing will change that."
"Psyche," said I, leaping up, "I can't bear this any longer. You've told me so many wonders. If this is all true, I've been wrong all my life. Everything has to be begun over again. Psyche, it is true. You're not playing a game with me. Show me. Show me your palace."
"Of course I will," she said, rising. "Let us go in. And don't be afraid, whatever you see or hear."
"Is it far?"
said I.
She gave me a quick, astonished look.
"Far to where?" she said.
"To the palace, to this god's house."
You have seen a lost child in a crowd run up to a woman whom it takes for its mother, and how the woman turns round and shows the face of a stranger, and then the look in the child's eyes, silent a moment before it begins to cry. Psyche's face was like that, checked, blank, happiest assurance suddenly dashed all to pieces.
"Orwell," she said, beginning to tremble, "what do you mean?"
I too became frightened, though I had yet no notion of the truth.
"Mean," said I, "where is the palace? How far have we to go to reach it?"
She gave one loud cry. Then with white face, staring hard into my eyes, she said, "But this is it, Orwell. It is here. You were standing on the stairs of the great gate.
Chapter 11. If anyone could have seen us at that moment, I believe he would have thought we were two enemies met for a battle to the death. I know we stood like that, a few feet apart, every nerve taut, each with eyes fixed on the other in a terrible watchfulness. And now we are coming to that